Patients, doctors, job creators, and Americans from all walks of life are being harmed and losing access to affordable coverage and the care that they need. That's why we welcome the Senate's proposal to provide Americans with much-needed relief from Obamacare. The Senate's proposal is built on
I'm Dan Diamond. This is Pulse Check, and that was HHS Secretary Tom Price applauding the Senate bill released Thursday to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. It's not clear yet whether Republicans will have the votes for the bill, but the party and Democrats are falling into their usual camps of either blasting the ACA or vowing to take it down. There was one person today I was especially interested in hearing from, Neera Tanden, the head of the Liberal Center for American Progress, and someone who is heavily favored to be HHS secretary if Hillary Clinton had won. I caught Neera Thursday morning before the health bill was posted and the day blew up. We spend the first half of this podcast conversation talking about Republicans' healthcare efforts, and the second half talking about Neera herself, what it's like running CAP, lessons from the campaign, and lessons for Democrats moving forward. You can check the time cues to jump around, and we'll get to that conversation in a moment. But first, as healthcare news continues to break, stay up to date. Subscribe to Politico Pulse, politico.com/politicopulse, the morning newsletter that I write, 6 a.m. for pros, 10 a.m. for everyone else. And follow my colleagues, especially Jen Habercorn, Rachna Pradhan, Adam Kankren, Brianna Ailey. They are embedded on the Hill, bringing the latest news to Politico readers. And with that, here's Neera Tanden on healthcare. We're talking a little after 10 a.m. on Thursday. The contours of the Senate bill have leaked, even though the official bill won't be out in time. Of course, listeners will have seen it by the time they're listening to this podcast. Based on what we know about the bill, Neera, and you thinking about it as a progressive leader, is this a disaster or is it more tolerable than you expected from Republicans?
What I'm surprised by is that the Senate would actually make substantial parts of their repeal worse than the House. So obviously we haven't seen the details, but in the broad strokes, they are essentially cutting Medicaid more deeply than the House. And they're oddly enough keeping they're keeping a little bit more of the framework around the exchanges than the House did. And so, but, you know, the Medicaid program is one that addresses the needs of the most vulnerable. So the irony is that in some really, in the most obvious way, the Senate bill is more cruel than the House bill, which, you know, I think is in some ways surprising. But, you know, again, one is authored by Mitch McConnell.
It's surprising because we were told for weeks that the Senate bill was going to be nicer. Trump said it needed to have more heart. And yet.
Oh, yes. In fact, Trump said the House bill was meaner, was mean.
Mean.
He said mean. Just a mean bill. And so you'd think that the Senate would become less mean. But instead, the direction they've chosen to go in is to, in order to preserve their tax cuts, do deeper cuts into Medicaid. And I think a thing that people don't really understand is this isn't just affecting the Medicaid expansion. This bill has now essentially a direct assault on the Medicaid program that existed before the ACA ever passed. And they're transforming it in a direction in which it makes it, I mean, we can go into per capita caps and all this stuff, but essentially cuts the program and how much it can help people and what it can do under the guise of flexibility.
I should say that you're making quote fingers.
I know.
Around
I'm sorry. You can't see the visuals of my face or my quote fingers, but
I'll do my best to narrate your unhappy expression when talking about this bill.
I mean, that is what is really kind of amazing about this process, which is it's been the ACA repeal is a bait and switch in multiple directions. First of all, it's they are essentially doing a massive tax cut for the wealthy in order to. Is part of this healthcare bill, but also it's, you know, this what they're trying to do to the Medicaid program is not something they've been trying to do, you know, something they've been trying to do for a few years. This has been a 30-year assault the contract with America was this was part of the contract Gingrich with America that the Republicans in the House couldn't get done in the mid-1990s. And they're using this bill as a vehicle to accomplish it. So, you know, what's weird about the debate we're having is not that we're setting back the Obama year policies. These are policies that were to the far right of George W. Bush that Trump is championing and trying to get passed.
Well, it's notable for a few reasons. One, as has been remarked, Trump campaigned on a promise not to cut the entitlement programs, including Medicaid.
Including Medicaid.
And that seems to be forgotten. Secondly, Medicaid is thought of very differently by the parties. I saw a poll, I think it was Kaiser Family Foundation, more than half of Republican voters think that Medicaid is welfare. Many fewer Democrats, I think 25% of Democratic voters, feel the same way about the program. So for Republicans, this is a chance to roll back what they see as a welfare program. And I know you disagree with that perspective.
Yeah, no,
on
no.
Medicaid.
But I mean, I think it's I obviously disagree substantively. But what the incredible irony of this is how much the Medicaid program helps rural America. You know, the hospitals that are going to close from these cuts are rural hospitals. The people who are going to lose coverage are anyone on the Medicaid program. But, you know, 25% of farmers receive Medicaid. So, you know, people, I know that there's an image of Medicaid as a program for just poor people in cities. But the Medicaid program in states throughout this country is providing health care to people in rural communities and exurban community, I mean, in suburban communities. And really, Medicaid funds the healthcare infrastructure of the of rural communities. And that's one of the reasons why these dramatic Medicaid cuts are actually going to have a deep effect on how we address the opioid crisis. And, you know, Medicaid is
a
actually
a paper that Center for American Progress just put out. And I think I plugged in Pulse on Thursday.
Yes, it's a program that.
What's synergy?
I mean, that's what I find so surprising about what Trump and the Republicans are doing. It's not, you know, I mean, I obviously think it's disgusting to use social policy or public policy to attack people of, you know, the opposing party. That is not what public policy should be about. It's actually not what politics should be about. But what's amazing about the healthcare debate we're having is how much the Republicans have used public policy to punish their own voters. I mean, as you know, Republicans passed a bill in the House. Every, you know, almost every Republican voted for a bill in the House that would, you know, for a 50-year-old man living in a rural community who makes $25,000 a year, it was an 8-fold increase in their premiums. If you're a 27-year-old who makes $75,000 and lives in a city, you had a premium increase. Not that much, though, right? It was like the least damage. So it's, you know, I think it's almost like they think they can do anything to those voters and they'll still keep them.
Well, it will be interesting to watch, just as Democrats took all this pain for unrelated health care problems that didn't have to do with the Affordable Care Act. There
yeah.
are always frustrations in health care, and they just accumulated onto the Democrats because they were perceived as the ones who had changed the health care system. Republicans are setting themselves up for similar punishment from voters who may not be affected directly by this, but will find, if the bill passes, but will find frustrations in the healthcare system that now accrue to the party in power. I want to go back to your read on the overall bill.
Mm-hmm.
Some conservatives that I've talked to this week are frustrated. They think it doesn't go far enough, that it keeps too much of the infrastructure around mm-hmm. the exchanges, which you pointed out, but also vis-a-vis Medicaid, they want to see the Medicaid expansion rolled back very quickly. And instead, the Senate bill is proposing a phase out over a number of years that sets Medicaid up to be an election referendum. So isn't it possible that the Senate could have gone farther and that this is the unhappy compromise that they've reached, which maybe isn't as stark as it could have been, but also isn't really winning over the folks in their party who are on the fringes that they need to bring on board?
Yeah, I think that, you know, look, healthcare policy is not easy, as we learned from taking over a year to pass the Affordable Care Act.
Some might say healthcare is complicated.
it's deeply complicated, hugely complicated. I guess what I would say to that is, look, the real problem for Republicans is that they have to litigate out deep differences on healthcare policy in this process because they did not litigate them out in the presidential campaign. So Obama was actually able to pass his healthcare bill because he'd actually campaigned on the same framework. And so he in 2000, you know, so I worked for President Obama in the general election, and we had a rich debate about it even in the primary. But his basic framework was one that he talked about, you know, a fair amount. We actually had a few questions in the debates in 2008 around them. He did advertising around it. And so, you know, I think the big problem for Republicans is that they've done repeal and replace for 7 years, but never actually said what the replacement is. Trump never said what the replacement is. And now they have to litigate these issues out, which is everyone can say, I want a real repeal and replace. But for senators who are in the expansion states like Shelley Moore Capito or
in West Virginia,
or Portman in Ohio, or now like Cassidy in a deep red state like Louisiana. John Bel Edwards, the governor, campaigned on a Medicaid expansion, became governor, and has actually done a Medicaid expansion. So in those states, they have real challenge, which is the Medicaid expansion is serving people, providing health care to hundreds of thousands of people in their state. And, you know, the big issue they're debating really is just when to get rid of the program. It's not like they're like, preserve it. It's like, I'm going to get rid of the program in 7 years after my next election or 2 years. So
the eventual outcome is going to be the same for the Medicaid program.
And, you know, that's why I think that it's up to, you know, leaders like Governor Kasich to say, you know, Republican leaders. And you've seen leadership from Governor Kasich. But, you know, I think they totally understand that if I'm going to, you know, essentially steal your car in 5 years versus 7 years versus now, it's still a loss. So, you know, they can't. I think that they're really just trying to litigate these issues out. And of course, the far right wants to destroy as much as they can of not just, again, let me just say, we're not talking about just the ACA expansion. They're now transforming the entire Medicaid program. And I don't understand how senators like Murkowski or Collins or even Shelley Moore Capito can look at their constituents in the face and vote this bill.
Well, they're playing a very interesting game right now of mocking the bill in the open, which may not actually mean anything when it comes to voting on the bill in the next couple of days or weeks. This bill is polling very poorly. Depending on where you look, it can be as low as 20%, might be as high as 35%. If it's so unpopular, why haven't Democrats been able to hang it around Republicans in special elections?
You know, I think this is a kind of a challenge, first of all, in every one of these special elections, to just tell you how unpopular it is. In every one of these special elections, the Republicans are essentially saying that they haven't taken a position on the bill.
And I should clarify, congressional special elections,
yes.
We just saw one in Georgia, another one in South Carolina. Democrats have lost these special elections despite some hopes that they could flip these districts.
And, you know, I'd say, like, across these five special elections, Democratic participation has been at 68%. Republicans have been at 56%. So there does seem to be an enthusiasm gap between the parties in voting. But I think one of the challenges they've had is that Republicans, you know, which I think is obviously ludicrous, but each of these Republican candidates, Karen Handel, never said how she'd vote on the bill. The House passed a bill. She wouldn't say that she would have voted for it or not voted for it. She danced on that for a really long time.
The Montana candidate, when asked directly about the CBO score, body slammed the reporter. That's how much he didn't want to talk about the health care bill.
I know, usually
put us all on notice as health reporters.
I got to tell you, like, a question about the CBO score, and I've had a fair amount of these in my life. It never occurred to me the answer was to, like, basically grab someone by the neck and throw them to the ground. But I'm a kind of petite person, so maybe it wouldn't have worked for me. So.
I have to remember this next time I have a hard questions for you. I've been intimidated in the past, but clearly that shouldn't be.
Yeah, I'm not likely to physically assault you for a CBO question. But I think that does actually demonstrate that we have that Republicans saw how unpopular this is. And I think the issue here is that they should really take note that in order to win Republican-leaning districts that, you know, have Republican lean of up to 20 points. So Tom Price won his district by 63-37. In November, he didn't have a well-funded opponent, but 63-27.
Tom Price, the open Georgia seat.
37.
Yeah.
And this was the Georgia seat, and he won that district by over 20 points. For Karen Handel to hold on, and she, you know, won by 4 points. But for her to do that, she had to basically outspend John Ossoff with outside money, I mean with super PAC money. But more importantly, had to dance on a whole series of issues, the budget, everything else, whereas Republicans who vote for this bill will not be able to dance. You know, they are going to have a vote. That vote is going to be clear what this bill does to you. And as we learned in the healthcare debate in 2009 and 2010, healthcare is like any other issue. Every American feels like an expert on the healthcare system because you have a very deeply personal experience with it. So, as you know, the Affordable Care Act didn't actually affect, you know, fundamentally employer-based coverage. It was really about building on the system that we had. And but yet, you know, people were easily scared about what could happen to them. Here, there's a bill that will literally cut 23 million people, or we'll see what the CBO score for this is, but since it affects the Medicaid program, still will likely have bad 10-year number. Cuts 23 million, but like addresses lifetime limits for employer-based coverage, a whole series of things that are going to affect people who are in the exchanges, outside of the exchanges. And I think that's, you know, I really think that's the lightning rod for people. They can understand what it means to go to a doctor and be scared about your insurance covering whatever your doctor just diagnosed.
Well, understanding that, would you like to see Democrats run more aggressively on healthcare right now? Could John Ossoff, who was in a district where the bill was polling very poorly, I think 62% of people opposed the bill, 80% of voters in that district felt very strongly about healthcare. He didn't take that many direct attacks on it in his closing message. Would you have liked to have seen more of that from him and other Democrats as they emerge over the next year?
I think Democrats should very much campaign on defending and, you know, fixing and defending the ACA versus destroying it. And I think people should get the candidates should understand what's in these bills. I hope that
they should link themselves specifically to Obamacare.
I think they should absolutely. I mean, if you look at the polling numbers now, it's like 60% or like, let's basically keep the ACA, have some fixes versus.
It's definitely been more than 50%, which is a big reversal from where
the
ACA
was. Yes, so on election day was a 38% approval rating, and it's obviously moved up. So my view is that candidates should get well-versed on particularly House candidates, they should get super well-versed on what the AHCA bill did that passed and really ask very pointed questions. You know, what I've been most excited about is the just level of specificity that people have been like piling into these town halls. They're asking really well-educated questions about pre-existing conditions, individual mandate, what it'll do. Like they have very good, you know, people want to know more information about this. And I think candidates should definitely run on it. You know, I'm not going to second guess John Ossoff or any of the candidates, Quist, others that ran. But my view is that this is a great, you know, a tragic real tragically, because we should not even be discussing this bill, but a real opportunity for Democrats to campaign on.
Hey, it's Dan Diamond, and we'll get back to the conversation with Neera in a moment, but I wanted to tell you about two things to put on your radar. First, I appeared on Politico's Nerdcast this week. It's our weekly podcast about politics and policy in a very data-driven way. It was a lot of fun, and you can find the Nerdcast podcast on all of your favorite podcast apps. It posts on Friday. And then next week, June 27th, I'm going to be a moderator at Politico's Outside In event. It's downtown DC at the Mayflower Hotel. We'll be looking at population health and how it's changing and evolving, especially as Republicans push their reforms forward. Joanne Kennan and Arthur Allen will be joining me from Politico. We've got Susan DeVore, Karen DeSalvo, Nick Dawson, and others to speak on the issue of population health in the industry. You can find out more at politico.com/events. Click on upcoming events to sign up and for details. And with that, let's get back to Neera Tanden. I will get back to healthcare, but wanted to talk a little bit about you and your background. Mm-hmm. And it's an open secret that if Hillary Clinton had won, she would have tapped you as HHS secretary.
Oh, no, no, no. We don't know that. This is just speculation. I mean, I was on the transition. I did not have that sense. But it's great when someone just reports it so that it's just like known as fact.
I will say enough reports have come out that, and from folks I know inside the administration, the last administration, as well as the reporting since, you were certainly on the short list to be HHS secretary, whether or not you want to.
I mean, have you seen that building? Would you really like to work in that building? No offense to everyone who works there. People probably can't visualize the ugliest building in America, but it is definitely up there.
It was on the short list, I think, of IJR's five ugliest buildings in D.C. And the first podcast we ever did for Pulse Check, Andy Slavitt, the head of CMS, I asked him at the end, is this the ugliest building that you've ever worked in or something? And he, you know, rushed to condemn it. So, yes, the Humphrey Building, not a destination
for aesthetics. You can Google it. It's not it's a masterpiece of intense ugliness.
Also a masterpiece, your ability to deftly avoid the direct question I was going to ask you about running HHS. But we are 5 months after inauguration. We're talking about what Tom Price is doing. What would you have done if you were running HHS at this point in a Clinton administration?
I mean, again, the hypotheticals are kind of crazy. But, you know, this is what's really tragic about the election. We would be, I mean, I would imagine, and it's not really me, but I would say I'd imagine that Hillary would have been very focused on how to both ensure that the ACA was functioning really well and think through ways to expand coverage. I mean, she had a career in which she was really passionate, and you saw it really whether she was first lady or senator or presidential candidate, very focused on expanding health care for people, and had done a lot of work, particularly on children's health insurance. And so, you know, in that world, we'd be discussing, you know, ways to ensure that we were expanding health care coverage, not figuring out ways to stop Republicans from basically eliminating health care for 23 million people.
So state public options, for instance, which had been on the table.
I mean, specific ideas were particular fixes, but state public options. So in states where insurers had left, you'd be able to create a public option so that there would be an insurer of last resort everywhere, which is, you know, actually, as I think people forget, like Los Angeles, parts of California have actually had Medicaid programs that are public. So, you know, there's models for it. So anyway, that's what we would have been doing. But shoulda, woulda, coulda. Here we are in the abyss.
I can only imagine what this past year has been like for you. Mm-hmm. You're a senior advisor to a campaign that suffered a surprising defeat. Mm-hmm. You've had vultures like me reading your emails that leaked on WikiLeaks.
It's so rude. You really shouldn't read people's emails. I mean, you really should spend your time. I mean, I don't think you should read someone else's emails if you're not wanting to make your emails public. Don't you think that's like a basically good theory of how to behave?
Well, it's been a source of a lot of newsroom debate, and I will say on the podcast, I would say to anybody who asked, it was not my favorite thing to do, and often felt kind of slimy reading through people's personal emails.
Oh, would it seem slimy and voyeuristic to actually read through people's personal emails to like their friends about things? Because that, you know, that is what it is.
Well, and you have a fair opinion. I would just say, as someone who gets emails forwarded to him all the time, including in today's Pulse newsletter, there was an email sent by someone within a major healthcare organization in America. If Tom Price and Reince Priebus were sending emails back and forth about the future of health reform under President Trump, that is the kind of thing that I would be expected to report. It just gets weird and off
right.
track.
The analogy here, just to say about my own case, is that I was not on the campaign. So it would really be like Reince Priebus and his friend outside going back and forth about what should happen on a campaign. But, you know, look, that was not a super fun experience. I do hope karma is real and that everyone else's emails will be exposed. But, you know, you're a perfectly nice person, so maybe it won't happen to you. But there are plenty of other people who somehow the Russians managed not to dump their emails. But, you know, maybe we'll live in a world in which the radical transparency will happen to other people. At the end of the day, like, I think what was surprising about that experience was how no one actually really spent time thinking that much here about why it happened and who was doing it. Whereas, you know, I'm actually surprised how much better the French media, the French government, et cetera, were dealing with the Russian hacking into the French elections.
The Macron leak that happened right before the election. My next question, it's not a policy question. It's just a personal one, a human one. You had a pretty rough experience. Are you okay?
I think so. I mean, I don't know. I guess what I would say is after the election, I realized that there are not a lot of institutions that have the ability to analyze what will happen to those 23 million people district by district or, provide information on what's happening in the budget. And really, for me, I think I have been able to focus on the work at hand. I mean, it's almost maybe it's fate that instead of taking up infrastructure, Trump decided to take on healthcare, an issue I worked on. And he's offering, the Republicans are offering not a bill that I think is bad on policy or whatever, but I think is like a morally outrageous bill. I mean, so the fact that people send themselves to Congress to basically rip away healthcare from the most vulnerable people, I find not like a interesting policy debate, but a moral affront. And so it very much focuses the mind on, and I've been very focused on ensuring the American people understand what's in this bill and what it would do to them. And I'm at least, I mean, there have been a terrible number of things that the Trump administration has done, but at the very least, the public has recognized that this bill is bad. And that's why we are living under the most outrageous process around this bill, which is essentially Mitch McConnell does not want to make the bill public except for a week out.
And the framework that's been made public is not going to be the final framework.
Yeah.
Where there might only be a matter of hours before the final vote. You alluded to running the Center for American Progress, where we sit, where there's a big banner behind me that says CAP all over it. During the W. Bush years, CAP was referred to often as the Clinton White House in exile.
I don't think it was the Clinton White House in exile. I think it was the White House in exile back then, but sure.
Well, that takes me to today. Is this now still the White House in exile for Democrats? Or do you feel like the locus of energy and momentum has shifted away from simply D.C. and there's been so much organizing around the country that there really can't be a White House in exile anymore?
I think waiting for a White House or being a White House in exile is just like no one has the luxury of that anymore. I mean, today we are seeing a frontal assault on a whole range of progressive issues. I mean, healthcare is the tip of the spear, but budget, tax, everything, what's happening on foreign policy. So for us, we are, we're focused on stopping as much of the kind of legislative assault as we can. And I do think that the energy that there's incredible energy in the country. And what's really important is to bring that energy into the debate. So we've spent a lot of time over the last couple of weeks, months, trying to get people who are concerned but like live in their communities to go to town halls or go call their members of Congress now. And I actually think one of the reasons why Mitch McConnell has kept the secret for so long is he's worried about direct democracy taking on this bill, and because it will have huge consequences for people. And, you know, people are always like, oh, people just don't like Trump or they're resisting. You know, the people who are flooding these town halls are people who are worried about losing their health care. They have friends and family of pre-existing conditions, and they're all, energized by what this bill will do to them. And so that's where I think the energy is. Now, there's a feedback loop. There's energy out in the country, but if you can get them to call their member of Congress. We just saw this great busload of indivisible folks who'd organized from West Virginia. They brought a whole slew of people in. Shelley Moore Capito met with them, as did Senator Manchin, and they both kind of talked about what their commitments were on this bill, which hopefully would be actually realized in how they vote. So I see the activism out there, but as where really the energy and future of progressive politics is. But I think we can play an important role in reminding people that it's not just 2018 that you can defeat Trump, where, it's important for people to vote. But there's really critical issues that will affect people fundamentally that the Congress is dealing with now.
Bring it back to CAP. There are so many young folks who either listen to this podcast or read Politico and reach out and ask for advice.
Really?
And say,
is that true?
It is true. It is true. I think every week I'm hearing from at least one grad student who says,
that's great.
I want, thank you. I'm coming on this podcast to get endorsements about this podcast from you. But the question is,
we'll just see how it ends. You haven't gotten an endorsement
that's
yet.
That's true. I shouldn't.
Don't like overplay your hand there, buddy.
I'm just a grubby reporter. I'm not a politician who knows when an endorsement is actually coming. It felt like one was on the horizon. But there are young folks who are asking, and I say young folks like I'm some old geezer,
yeah.
But there are grad students who are asking, how can I get involved? What should I do? And I had this conversation with someone a week or two ago, disproportionately liberal and progressives, who say, I want to fight the Trump agenda.
Yeah.
And I really have my dream job is working for Neera Tanden or Andy Slavitt or whoever it might be. But you only
send him our way.
Well, but you can't hire everybody. And, talking about the activists out in the community. So if there is a 25-year-old who's steeped in healthcare, is that person best served coming to a think tank, a policy shop like CAP, or going out in West Virginia, Ohio, someplace where there might be less of that activism and more need for on-the-ground expertise?
So that's a great question. It reminds me, we're doing a lot of work with Andy Slavitt and you know, he's doing these town halls and districts, and they're like
districts where representatives aren't showing up,
where the Republicans aren't holding town halls at all. And he's getting, you know, hundreds of people to come out and talk. So I guess I'd say, look, my broad analogy is that, you know, the election kind of wiped out a lot of the field on the progressive side. So we do need more and more people to engage in the debate, engage in the fight. You know, we can't hire everybody, but we are actually trying to think through how we can, you know, expand our horizon, like set up advisory groups, et cetera, just so you can pull people into the debate. So, but it is vital. Like if you're concerned about healthcare and you live in a swing state, you know, do what you can, you know, and contact us. We'll provide you tools about how you can engage and engage your members of Congress and your senators. This is really the crunch time. This week is really the crunch time. Today, tomorrow, the upcoming days, really vital for people to recognize what this bill will do and how it will hurt people. And it's critical that people's voices are heard. You know, as you know better than I do, at the beginning of this year, you know, the Republican plan was to have this bill passed and signed by Memorial Day. The only reason why that hasn't happened is because there's been so much public opposition, opposition in town halls, opposition in calls to Congress. And so
people showed up and sat in Rob Portman's office yesterday from Ohio because they said that he wasn't holding enough representation.
Absolutely.
There.
And it's made people recognize that's a problem. I mean, if you think about where we were at the beginning of this debate, where they wanted to pass a repeal and then 3 years later come up with their plan, that was stopped because people said that's crazy, right?
Talking about repeal now, replace later.
Yeah.
I want to challenge this, though. Even with all of those town halls, the clips that went viral, the representatives who were shouted down, it still got through the House. And we are now in a position where Democrats and activist groups can say what they want, but it's all on the Republicans and what they choose to do.
Absolutely. This has been from the beginning. They've used a process of reconciliation in order to ensure that it is just a partisan vote to get rid of this bill, right? And people can say what they want about the ACA, but they use the normal process. There were markups, there were hearings. A lot of Republican amendments were taken. We didn't get a lot of Republican votes, but a lot of Republicans were amendments.
There was
were
like
taken.
One Republican vote along the way,
yes.
Not for the final bill. So if
I'd say this is the big question, which is
the $800 billion
question, or a couple trillion-dollar question, which is. The public opposes this bill, whether it's 30% support or 17% support. The vast majority of the country does not want this bill to pass. The Republicans can choose to pass it because partisanship is the most important thing to them. They can make that decision, but they will do it against the interests of the majority of the country, which they are well aware of. The ACA while we were debating the bill, it was always like a 45, 50 issue. It was not 27% as we went.
There was a poll by Quinnipiac 2 days before the Senate voted in 2009. 35% of Americans approved of the healthcare process then. That's basically on par with the Politico Morning Consult poll that came out yesterday about the Republican bill, which I think said 36%.
Of the process, but the bill itself.
Well, of
the more
plan. Of the plan.
I remember this number is a little higher. But what I'm saying is, it's look, the Republicans have the ability to pass this bill. They only need 50 votes in the Senate. There are 52. There are 52 senators.
And so, Pence is the tiebreaker.
So they just need 50 votes. We need 3 votes to stop this bill. And that's really the question, whether Republicans, it's absolutely not up to Democrats. We can't filibuster this bill, or Democrats can't filibuster this bill. They don't have a lot of tools in the arsenal to deal with it. They will exhaust all that they can. But at the end of the day, it's going to be a decision by Republicans. And that's why all the swing voters are Republicans on this. And that's the activism we have in front of us.
And you are bringing every tool to bear, your staffers, Topher's out on Twitter, mobilizing people to call. If this bill passes, is that a failure for the progressive movement? Is it a failure for CAP?
But it's – so my issue about this is it's not – first of all, anytime you're fighting for the right thing, I don't think it's a failure. The reason why we're doing this is because we have to do everything we can to stop this bill because it'll drop coverage for millions of people. That's the calculus. I mean, there is a – if you were thinking completely tactically, right, if we were all thinking tactically, Democrats would say pass the bill. Because it's hugely unpopular. We went through this. And it's, you know, when you have Republicans in swing in 20-point Republican districts not saying whether they support a bill or not, that tells you how toxic it is. And so the fact that it's that toxic means it'll be a big problem for them. I mean, I know their Democratic strategists were like, this is a win-win, right? If they pass the bill, it's good. If they don't pass, but that's not how we should think about this. What we should think, and I'm proud of Democrats for trying everything they can to stop this bill because it is a moral outrage. Even if it helps us, it helps Democrats in the future election. It's not the reason why it should not be the reason we take action.
Last question. You are passionate. You are well-spoken. You are thoughtful. You are a progressive leader. Will you ever run for office? Has this moment, I mean, anyone can be president, Neera. That's one thing we learned from the past year.
Anyone can be president. And, you know, I'm really excited.
And you're already the head of an organization.
I'm really excited about all these people running. I mean, if you look at the people running around the country.
The Gelato King in Minnesota.
This Iron Stash, at Iron Stash, you know, the iron worker out in, who's challenging Paul Ryan. I mean.
He's probably not going to win.
These teachers, that's a great ad. I really recommend people look at this ad. They're teachers, they're business owners, there's advocates all stepping up to run. And I think it's really exciting. And I think I conceive of my job as to, you know, really be about focusing on what Congress is doing, you know, also developing an agenda for the future for progressives who want to run or anyone who wants to run. Our ideas are open to everybody, conservatives and liberals. I'm really excited for other people to take up that leadership. And I just could not make my trolls so happy as to run for office. Their heads might explode. So
it would be good business for Twitter.
It would be good business for Twitter.
All those trolls that you continue to engage, and I had all these questions about why you still do it, but unfortunately,
I'm going to do less and less of that in the future.
I've heard that from you before, and yet there you are battling it out on the Twitter front lines. Mm-hmm. Neera Tanden, thank you for making time to talk about healthcare, your career, and CAP on such a busy day in D.C.
Thank you so much. It was great to be with you, and thank you for all the important coverage you do of what this bill will actually do for people or do to them.
That does sound like an endorsement. I'll take it. That's it for Pulse Check today. Thank you so much to Neera Tanden and the team at CAP for making time. Thanks to Bridget Mulcahy for following me around D.C. on a very busy day. You can find Pulse Check at all of the usual podcast places. Please recommend us, review us, rate us, especially as healthcare stays in the news. And we'll be back with a new episode of Pulse Check very soon.